should be in the middle. Michael's in the middle. Michael in the middle.
Michael in the middle. It's like the start of a show.
Why don't we have an extra chair over there? In memoriam.
That's right. That would be a fun game.
Yeah, somebody is.
All right. So, Tyler, you've got a roving mic for a little bit. Okay, so the purpose of our panel discussion tonight is really to allow you to grill Gary, but the rest of us might occasionally jump in too. But, you know, we realized that having a talk on courtship this morning, it's sort of starting a conversation again that we haven't had very recently as a church, and we want to be available to you to answer questions that you might have. If you don't have many questions, I've got some questions for these guys that I think would be useful for you all to hear their answers on. But primarily, we want to hear questions from you all and take a crack at answering them. One of the questions that we've already received is, why do we have all these young guys up here? Why, thank you. But in all seriousness, you know, there's a whole lot of wise people sitting out there who have had sons and daughters get married already. Of course, Gary has one married child. And naturally, we're down an elder here. Normally, Roger would have been here with us as well. And so we would have had a little bit more older experience with us. But, you know, as elders and pastors, we are charged with the oversight of your souls. And so we're not saying that we know more than everybody, certainly not. In fact, I would hope that if this is something you've got questions about, that you would go to some of the older folks in the room who have a lot of wisdom and experience and talk to them and get their thoughts. And if you don't know who to talk to, we can give you some names. But nevertheless, we do want to at least make ourselves available to you. So I know that was one of the questions we had received. Did I get that right,
yes, Gary?
Oh, for you. Questions are coming in via text. Wow, this is so modern. Let's see. Question for the panel. Question. Oh, it says maybe for Michael. So it could be for Gary. In his talk, he talked briefly about older people not waking love in young people before it's time. Could he expand on what he meant by that? Yeah. So I think that there's times when we, whether it be as parents or just adults, we might, perhaps without intending to do so, we might start putting pressure on young people to start, we might be at a wedding, for example. And maybe someone's getting married, and we might ask one of their younger siblings, or maybe we would ask some of the younger people there, oh, are you next? Or, oh, so do you have your eye on anybody? You know, there's times when we adults can be kind of annoying to young people. And probably we shouldn't do that if they're not actually people who are ready for a marriage. Why would we encourage them to start thinking about, struggling with, getting concerned about something that isn't necessarily their time of life yet? Those are my initial thoughts in terms of that question, but others may have better responses.
Yeah, we got it. I'll just add to that, you know, one of the things that I think can often do that is talking about specifics versus talking about the abstract. I thought Michael's exhortation to be thinking early on in terms of what are your non-negotiables is a really good exercise to be doing with teens. And when that's done in the abstract, I think is really helpful when you start kind of planting seeds about specific people and possibilities when there is no chance of that happening in the next several years. I think that's where you get into trouble. The other thing I was going to add to what Michael said is that this concept of not stirring up love before it pleases is a community one, and it doesn't just apply to the older folks. I think us parents and grandparents of teens have a big role to play, but y'all's peers have a big role to play as well, and probably will be in more conversations where that may come up, and you have an opportunity to exhort one another to, let's not talk about that, or let's not think about that right now. Are you really ready to do anything about that and to encourage one another to not stir up love? I think that's a big part of it as well.
Just as a follow-up to that, I think our present culture is structured in such a way to arise, to bring about love in an ungodly, unhealthy way, certainly. But that's because they have assumed that all love is porneia, all love is pornified, if I should say that way, instead of agapified, instead of a love rooted in biblical truth. And so the entire entertainment industry is geared to bring out the kind of love that's immature, and it is geared to teach all of our young children that to pursue love is a noble goal, whether mature, prepared for it or not. And so one of our fundamental tasks these days is to be very discerning in what our children watch. And if they do watch certain things, we ought to be very self-aware. We have to do our proper homework as parents, review what they are watching. They're going to a friend's house, and they're watching a few things that you may not be aware of. And so you got to create a culture in the church where moms are very aware what other moms are watching, what they're allowing their children to watch when they're playing over there. So just be aware of these things, because the entertainment industry is driven, it is equipped, it is prepared with a lot more resources than what our churches offer today. They are prepared with fancy graphic equipment, and we need to be very self-aware of these kinds of things as it comes through our screens.
Let's see. We've got some questions in the audience as well. Oh, speaking of experience, John Unger.
Whether it's wise or foolish, that's another question. But so I think I would suggest that the text that you're referring to, Don't Stir Up Love, is actually encouraging a self-preservation, right? The daughters of Jerusalem are charging, you know, I charge you daughters of daughters, don't stir up love. So there's another aspect of it. It's that we don't stir up love in ourselves, right? We have a self-composure that guards our own heart, right? but my question is related to this, and that is, so there are different approaches to guarding against that. I think of Jim West's book, Christian Courtship Versus the Dating Game. I know some parents have used that. We you know, referred to it. But there are different ideas about what kind of touching, for example, is good, proper, improper within a courtship or dating relationship. I wonder if you could speak to that and how it relates to that idea. Doug Wilson says, it's a great phrase, don't heat the oven until you're ready to cook the roast, right? But anyway, I just wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah, Gary would love to speak to that.
Sure. I look at these relationships, you know, like if we're talking about how far in touching can you go. Well, look at this, and I'm coming from the man's perspective here, of course. This is your sister. Do you want to kiss your sister on the lips? Do you want to be touching your sister where you shouldn't be touching her? These are the things that, you know, are also going to go back to, you know, that love thing too early. And I think that's how I would encourage young men that, you know, this is your sister. And she's always going to be your sister. You know, the whole thing, why do you date? You know, that's the big starting point. Why do you date? And everything is you date to find a spouse. It's all about marriage. And eventually you're going to be marrying a sister, and you're still going to treat her as a sister, but it will change. But in everything we do, this is your sister. And if you keep that in mind, this is a sister in Christ. It's a child of God. That's, I think, what I would say when it comes to touching. So pretty much, you know, don't be kissing until they say you may kiss a bride.
And remember, these are method things we're talking about, right? These are family things. Remember, this is family government. These are house rules we're talking about. So none of us here is going to try to bind your conscience with respect to an answer to that type of question. You know, my answer in terms of my own thoughts on it might be slightly different than Gary's. I think ultimately you want two people to get married who are really looking forward to consummating that union, right? You would expect them to. But I think physical touch does have the effect of ramping up those emotions and that stirring up of love very quickly. And so it does seem to me that it would be wise to delay that until there is far greater certainty in terms of where that relationship is headed toward marriage. I never asked my wife if I could tell stories. This one's harmless.
You know a guy.
So I know a guy who went to school at the University of Idaho. And so as you may or may not know, Ellie and I both went to the University of Idaho. I was already crazy about Ellie before we went to the University of Idaho. And we got there, and probably within the first month or so, we were just going for a walk. And I remember we were crossing some railroad tracks. And I grabbed her hand as we were crossing the railroad tracks. And I actually have no idea why I did that, except when I was thinking about it later on, I think it's because my parents, when we were kids, whenever we would cross the railroad tracks, I guess out of just protecting us, they'd always grab our hands, and we would walk to, you know, as we crossed the railroad tracks. So just instinctively, I grabbed her hand as we crossed the railroad tracks. And as we go over the railroad tracks, she kind of looks at me and... She's probably shaking like a leaf, you know, and, you know, wrenches her hand away. And it's like, okay, I guess I'm not doing that again. But, you know, I'm grateful that was how she was raised, because that wasn't something that was an issue. And so I'm glad that in our case, at least, the lack of physical touch was very helpful in, you know, preserving our purity.
Can I say something? Okay. So I just to also add to that, I think that this is an area where it's probably helpful for the father of the girl to lay down clear guidelines, as awkward as that is, and not leave it up to how that couple happens to be feeling about their relationship to Jesus at that moment in time. If they just simply kind of keep navigating how they're feeling and pushing towards purity and getting put in this, but if there are clear guidelines, and the father, as awkward as it is, checks in on it and just, you know, keeps an eye on it, and I think that can be very helpful and freeing to that couple to just simply say, this is what is allowed, and this is where we're not going to go. And the other thing which I've encouraged in my family is just to always consider what if the dad walked in right at that moment, you know, are you going to like jump away? Are you going to like drop the hand? Or just always imagine that her dad is just sitting like right there, and you know.
That's great. So.
Melinda and I made a proposal to my future father-in-law, and he agreed that we could kiss when we got engaged. So I worked a lot to get engaged very quickly. And I proposed, and our first kiss was the night we got engaged. And so, you know, these methods are going to vary between parents, but I really would encourage parents to really consider these things as your children get older. Two other things. The first one is that the Bible has a very rich theology of the body, and we need to realize that once bodies come together, there's always a purpose in it. In cultures that are very very romantic, like romantic language is like in Latin culture, I know that this is not very, very common sometimes in the cultures that I'm around here in the U.S., But my encouragement to parents, let's say they would say, well, we're just not a very emotional or a huggy kind of people. Well, force yourself to be. I would encourage you to kiss your children, to hug them, so that the first experience they have of hugs and kisses are from mom and dad, not from some boy they find down the road. Many of the occasions I have seen in my pastoral ministry are of girls who are unloved by their fathers. Kiss your daughters, love them, hug them, so they can experience what true masculine biblical hugs and kisses mean first before they experience the kisses of another man.
Next question. Oh, we have one on the phone first, I guess. Question about chaperoning and courtship. If you can't trust a young man to be alone with a young lady, should he even be considered as a suitable young man? For example, a young couple going on a date alone. One of you guys want to take a crack at that first?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. When I walked in to meet my wife, Stanley, for the first time, my father-in-law was conveniently cleaning all his guns. He was cleaning three of them at the same time. I said, well, that's providence. What are the chances of that happening? I think you need to have a very educated sense of what this man is, who this young lady is, their level of maturity, who they are in Christ, what their record is in the community. Are they the kind of people that are prone to separating themselves? Just as a theoretical sort of case here, let's say they're in a group with a bunch of kids. Are they the kind of people that like to sort of sneak off, divorce themselves from the community? Or are they the kind of people that enjoy hanging out in the cafeteria late at night on a camp like this till everybody else leaves together? So these are the kinds of practical things you need to see in mind. If a young man does have the tendency to leave and abandon the community that he's a part of to kind of sneakily go to the side to chat, I'd be suspicious. And so these are the kind of practical things you can see and experience and take a picture of in your community before you begin to deal with the question that was just posed.
So I love that analogy about the gun. But it's interesting the way I've talked, and I don't want to go into my family too much, but I always felt that, you know, you hear these stories about the gun and the bullet holes around the door. I felt it was important enough that I bought a shotgun for my daughter, as in, she's the one who knows when it's time to say, hey, this guy's no good. And the better training I've given for my daughters and my sons is that, you know, they're cleaning their own shotgun. And they're also keeping aware of who's coming through. If this guy is the wrong guy, then I want them to be able to make that call and say, this guy's the wrong guy. And I know love gets involved and things like that, but just using that same analogy about shotguns and things like that. So
I think just being a Calvinist, a young man that you can't trust in any circumstances probably is not ready for marriage. There is no man that you would trust in every single circumstance except Jesus. So, like, I think it depends on the circumstances that you're creating. If you're putting yourselves in a lot of temptation, the likelihood is really high among the sons of men that they're going to do what the sons of men do, even the best of them. But anybody, a young man that can't be in any circumstance and he's going to try to make a pass, he's going to try, like, that's someone that really needs to kind of mature more, because that's probably not going to end well, is my take on it.
Yeah, my own thoughts would be that kind of depends on what stage of this relationship things are at, right? This chaperoning question. You know, I'm not interested in a guy taking out my daughter just to get to know her. Not interested in that. I'm interested in them getting to know each other in a group setting, and at some point,
if he wants to pursue her, I'd like him to talk to me about it. And then there may very well be a process whereby there's some time that they're able to spend together. But I would, that's my hope for how that would work.
I just wanted to ask what definition of courtship and what definition of dating you're dealing with and how they differ and which one is preferable over the other and why.
Yeah, I guess I'll start first because I gave the talk this morning. I actually wasn't trying to define those terms intentionally. Frankly, what I care about most is that those principles I was talking about this morning are being applied. And from what I can tell, what most people call courtship attempts to apply those principles better than what most people call dating. But I recognize that there are Christians out there that have sort of rebranded dating into something that follows a lot of those principles. And they don't call it courtship, they call it dating. So to me, it's less about the labels and more about, you know, how are you applying those principles?
Well, I think if you take the two positions as just being a set of activities and a set of activities, that's one thing, which I think it almost makes them arbitrary. But I think at the heart of what Michael was saying this morning was that Numbers 30 passage, the father has authority. And if that's true, then all dating is courtship with an incredibly low bar. There only is courtship. There only is the father's permission. He's just tacitly giving it completely away. But he has the authority. He's just not. It's also another interesting thing in that passage is that he can hear his daughter making a vow. He can see this happening. He can just say nothing. And the vow just goes through as she vows. And that's, I think, equivalent to that idea of I just let my daughter do what she wants out here. He still has the authority and the responsibility over her. He's just allowing it to happen.
And frankly, that's one of the main motivations for my talk this morning. You know, I know as a father that one of my sinful tendencies would be toward laziness or a degree of passivity. And not doing something that I ought to do, right? And so hopefully this is a wake-up call for all of us who have children that are approaching this age that this is not the time for passivity. This is the time to be very engaged.
Yeah, definitions is something that we in the CREC absolutely love. We love to be glued to definitions because that gives us some sense of superiority over other systems. And I am no fan of that whatsoever. I have seen courting systems come to absolute disasters, and I've seen a lot of dating systems come to absolute disasters. We need to be less in love with definitions and more in love with the relationship itself and how it unfolds. I understand the desire to have definitions, but I think you can't remove, if to date involves some level of love and to court removes love from the occasion, then both are in some ways, we need to include both, right? It's impossible to see two human beings that are created to love, created to care, created to show concern, not express a desire to date someone. That's the kind of thing you need to keep in mind. So I think both are true. I would use both. But the reality I think we need to keep in mind is that when we consider these things, we have to deal with the fact that fathers ought to be involved. That's the first element here. When fathers are not involved, which is an element we fail to talk about when we talk about courtship or dating, sometimes fathers not involved. Sometimes fathers are very passive, and they need pastors to come along and make them feel really uncomfortable. And I love doing that in my congregation, making them really uncomfortable. This is your duty. This is what you were created for, to protect your daughter, to protect your son. And so when fathers are passive, or if there's cases where there are widows in the congregation, the Bible is very specific that pastors are to care for the widows of the church. And so pastors assume then a fatherly role in that situation. And I have done that in a couple of occasions with widows where I have helped through situations and relationships. and which has led to the altar, and I officiated their weddings. And so just remember that part of the assumption here is that fathers are involved. Where we need to be is we need to see fathers involved, because that's not the reality in most churches. Even in the CREC that puts a high regard for parental involvement, we still have men that are very passive. So that's, I think, a fundamental starting point for us as churches, is that men be on the same page in this regard.
We have a question here about online dating for singles, 20s, 30s, those that don't have any other eligible singles around.
Yeah, I can talk to that, because I think the last I have, when I get back home, Pensacola, I have, there's 6 weddings the next 5 months that I have to do. It'll be, I think I've done 32 weddings. It'll be close to 40 by the end of this season here. The last 6 weddings I've officiated, 4 of them have happened through online dating. So listen, it's the reality. Now, when I started in the CREC back in 08, we had 35 churches. There weren't that many options there. This is what I would do. I would have a budget to take my kids to, as they get older, to as many CREC camps as possible. And make sure that they make friends, they befriend people that are like-minded, and make sure that the options are many, not few. And I would echo what Michael said earlier in his helpful talk this morning, that like-mindedness is essential in this regard. And so in online dating, when you don't have all these ingredients, it's always interesting that the couples that I've officiated weddings for, when they write their profiles, these dating websites, you know they're CREC. You know. There's 6 qualifications, 7 doctrinal statements, 3 confessions, 100 Bible verses. And so, paedo communion. So you want daughters that are equipped to be able to answer these questions so that little silly evangelical men don't trick them.
Thank you for the plug for Gloria Sancta this summer. Amen. Appreciate that.
You know, I can be on a soapbox here. One of the things that really frustrates me is when people don't do the type of thing that Yuri just said. I remember Burke Shade many years ago. It was funny to hear him say it, but he said, yeah, my strategy was I bring as many of my kids as possible, especially my daughters, to the presbytery meetings, because then all the other pastors will meet them, and I'd have somebody at my home church that I should introduce, you know. But in all seriousness, it's always puzzled me how reluctant people are to put themselves out there. You know, we have a CREC list, and from time to time there will be a bio that comes out where a pastor says, hey, I've got this great young man or this great young woman in my congregation, and they're looking for a spouse, and it gets circulated. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who want to get married who won't let us send out a bio, and I don't understand it. And there's all these camps, there's these other things. I'm done.
Yeah. All right, we got one on text here.
Well, and I would just want to try to add to that a little bit. That doesn't remove all the other principles, right? So online dating, sure. Autonomous dating online is just as problematic as autonomous dating with someone in real life. And so I would still encourage as much communal involvement, as much pastoral involvement as you could have, even in a situation like that. But yes to the online thing.
So just as a follow-up, with all the young ladies and young men who have ended up marrying, it's interesting. Even if it's a young lady, eventually the young man comes to our church. If it's a young man, the young lady comes to our church. There is a kind of gravitas that we bring to the table that most evangelicals are just not prepared for, and we usually win the day. So that's a great, great thing, especially our young ladies get older. They're going to lack options. Thankfully, when I came, we had 35 churches. Now we have 100-plus churches. So the numbers are in our favor.
Here, let me do one on text first. Here's a good one. I want to know what these guys think. What advice would you give to a young person who is drawn to romance but is not at the point in life maturity and wisdom wise to be in a relationship to pursue marriage?
Drawn to romance. I don't know many people who are drawn to romance in the abstract. I think they're normally drawn to an individual. I suppose people can be, you know, I've read books about this. I've never experienced this. But apparently sometimes young women really look forward to having a family and children from an early age. And so I don't know if that's the sort of thing that the question relates to or if it's more about being drawn to an individual person. I'm going to assume it's being drawn to an individual person. And if that's the case and they're too young to pursue it, I'd say stop it. Make the choice. I mean, stop it. If you're not ready, you're not ready. And if your field's not made ready, it's not time to build your house.
Yeah. And I would just remind you that Proverbs 31 was very likely written to a young man to help him to understand the type of woman that he should be aiming at and the type of competencies and abilities that he should be building to be a complement to her. And so one of the things, I agree with you, if it's in terms of awakened love, then I agree with what you're saying. But one way that you can kind of direct them is, well, listen, that just means if this is something that you're really interested in, you've got a lot of work to do. You know, this is the time to prepare, you know, to build your competencies and your abilities so that you can be a really good mate to someone.
Yeah, I've talked to young men who, you know, they're excited about a relationship. You know, they want to be a father and they want to be a husband and be talking. And it's like, do you have a job? No. Do you have a car? Well, no. You know, so I think sometimes there's maybe it's in love with the idea of being in love, and they get distracted from things that they should actually be doing, like Devin said, to prepare. So, okay, fine, that's great. You have a noble aspiration, perhaps, but are you the kind of person that would be able to enter into that? If not, you got a lot of work to do, right? So what are the virtues of a husband or a father? What are the virtues of a wife or a mother? If those aren't present, get to work on those. Worry about this other thing later. And then when you've got those, then you can worry about the thing. Because otherwise, all you're going to do is end up hurting a lot of people.
So for those of you who don't know, I'm Brian Carter. We attend the King's Congregation in Meridian, Idaho. Alan Burrow is pastor there. He's given some insight, so I have one qualifier. My question is coming. The first one is, He has five daughters, and he gave this wonderful sermon on how the bridegroom pays for everything. So the first thing you ask the prospective son-in-law is, what can you pay for? That's another topic. Proverbs 31 was brought up recently by Doug Wilson, and he said it really is a Proverbs 31 man that it starts out with, and that would be a good thing to look at there. What is, like you said, what is God speaking to us there? One aspect that Alan Burrow brought up, and he brings up in sermons here, is that, get your perspective on this. He said, if, you know, the man is to leave his mother and father and cling to his wife. He said, but really before that, and you'll find this, not every situation may not necessarily have this, but that the man, the prospective son-in-law, becomes a friend to the father. Not just someone who's interested in his daughter, but that a friendship there is built first. And he kind of gave the thing, well, hey, you know, if I have work done that I have on my roof or my house, you know, come over and help me with that. Show me who you are. What would be your perspective in that simple? It's just an application. Do you see benefit in that kind of thing where you befriend and you become friends with the person who's prospective son-in-law?
You know, it's interesting you ask that question, Brian, because there are certainly guys I respect, pastors in the CREC, who very much take that, have that perspective. In fact, I've even heard it described as date the dad. I'm not sure that I have much to say on that. I can understand the motivations for that. I think that's very much a house rules deal, and I don't know if you all have any wise things to say on it.
I don't know how wise it is.
I've got friends. And if we end up becoming friends one day, great. But if this guy's coming after my daughter, we're not friends yet, you know. So, all due respect to whoever said that. Michael was softer with it than me, but I don't need any more friends. Especially not 22-year-olds.
So while Tyler is moving, one for Michael and Devin. Do I have to be completed schooling before I start dating?
Sure. It's up to the dad. I think that's up to the father, and there's different circumstances where I'm just thinking as a father myself, I would look at the circumstances. What prospects do you have here? You know, what are your bona fides? Like it says, it just I don't think everybody needs to necessarily go to college, but you got to have a plan. And where, you know, you're going to bring children into the world. Where are you going to put them? How are you going to feed them? So to have a plan, but do you need to be finished with that? Or are you going to be, so one principle that is absolutely true that everybody needs to realize is you get married, you need to expect that 9 months later, there's going to be a child. And, the idea that it's just, you have a plan. Well, we're going to start having children maybe 3 or 4. That, I know so many people, that is not their story. 9 months later, baby. So you got to plan for that. You got to be ready for that. And, whatever that looks like, if you're a sophomore in college, that's going to be hard. That's going to make finishing college a much greater challenge. But, so I would just go back to obviously the Bible doesn't say anything about that exactly, except what Michael, I thought bringing out that, what was that Proverbs? You know, you make the field and then build a house. I think that's a really good principle to keep in mind. But the most important issue in all this is what does her dad expect?
So the question was about, do you have to finish school before you start pursuing a serious relationship? Is that essentially the question? Well, let's compare it to the stock market. So in the stock market, there's value investing and there's growth investing. And, you know, value companies are the companies that are stable, a long track record. Perhaps they throw off some nice quarterly dividends. And you can pretty much count on them to do well in good times and bad. They'll ride out this recession that's coming. And then you got your growth stocks. And your growth stocks, you know, some of those are newer stage companies. They may have a lot of amazing ideas that could change the future. And a lot of them are going to fail. So a lot of them you're going to lose money on, but there's going to be some diamonds in the rough that are fantastic. And I think it takes wisdom to discern what's a growth company that you want to invest in versus one that's going to fail. And I don't envy my father-in-law over there who had to try to figure that out about me because I was so anxious to marry his daughter. It was a great blessing to me that Mike and Rachel allowed us to get married between our junior and senior years of college. But it certainly had to have been a big leap of faith. And so I think Devin's quite right in terms of it's going to very much depend on each individual circumstance. But, I think that the younger the people are and the less far along they are with respect to careers, et cetera, the more it's going to be like one of those growth stocks, and you're going to have to really do your due diligence and really take the time to understand the trajectory of that young person.
I think, you know, who knows your children best? You know, I think it's the parents, right? You know your children. You're not going to know this other possible mate for them. But you can sure, you know, as Michael talked this morning, there is a parental involvement in all of this. And you know your child well. And you know whether they're ready or not. Whether they're in their junior, senior year, whether they're halfway through, whether they're even done. You know, they may be already working, have a career that's a long-term value, but they may not be ready. So I think every relationship needs to be judged on that relationship and those people. It's hard to put a template on it, saying, okay, you're 21, you've graduated from school, you're ready to go. I think everything needs to be measured for each relationship.
Yeah, and I would say even if just because you finished college doesn't mean you're ready, right? I think asking the question, Michael's point about trajectories, yeah, what trajectory are they on, but how long have they been on that trajectory? You know, I think you brought up in your talk something really important. Twinkle in the eye, your eyes meet, your heart flutters, and I'm now real serious about Jesus. You know, I don't know how many times I've seen that, and it's real flattering to feel loved and real flattering to be excited. But if that's a really short time they've been on that Jesus trajectory, I would tap the brakes. I don't care if you're 7 years out of college, you know. So, yeah.
College also for some guys is not helpful for them moving in this trajectory. Depending on the thing that they choose to major in, they can come out with a degree in basketry or, you know, it's like it doesn't necessarily, you know, and they've been spending 4 years in basically camp and someone else cooking for them and cleaning their bathroom, you know, that doesn't bode well necessarily.
Well, just another point here. Paul says it is better to marry than to burn. There's the reality of the sexual tension that exists, and the longer this couple has known each other, I always favor short engagements. If you do 2-year engagements, I will not officiate your wedding. I will not let it happen. You set a time, and if they don't know, they're engaged, and they come to me and they say, we want to start premarital counseling, but we're not sure when we're going to get married. Let me help you. Here are 7 dates for you to choose. This is when I'm available to officiate this wedding. And you want to put that on paper, because once a timeline is placed in your Google Calendar, then seriousness emerges and it begins. And then they can begin to plan accordingly. But when is this sort of indefinite reality, that's just danger zone there. And so however long you're going to court or date, whatever you do, short engagements. Short engagements.
So 2 things, and I realize it's 8 o'clock, so I think we will keep going for those of you who want to continue having the discussion. But for those of you who want to start getting down to the beach or do other things, you're welcome to do that. Don't feel like you have to stay. But we will keep going for a while for those of you that want to stay. Yuri, I actually wanted to ask you a follow-up question about that. So it's amazing the things that can come up between a couple in premarital counseling. A lot of big things. And I'm wondering, do you think, number one, that's because fathers have done such a poor job on the front end ferreting those things out before they got engaged? Or, conversely, do you think that there ought to be some sort of pre-engagement counseling?
Pre-engagement counseling. That's an interesting question. I do think that the institution of marriage is an ecclesiastical institution. It does not belong to the family. It's a pastor that officiates the wedding. It's by the authority of the church, not the state of Florida or Oregon. And it's not by the authority of dad. Dad gives the daughter. It is the minister who pronounces them married. So it's an ecclesiastical institution. We need to stop thinking that marriages belong to the patriarchy or that it's a familial institution alone. It's not. Once a couple is married, they are included, incorporated into the life of the church as one. And so it's the first thing to keep in mind. And secondly, I think pastors that have developed healthy relationships with their young parishioners, which I always encourage pastors to be aware of the teenagers in their congregations. In our church, we have a pattern of I encourage fathers to encourage their teenagers to have coffee with me. And when they do have coffee with me, to come prepared with a 3x5 card with 5 to 7 to 10 questions to ask. And that's a good thing for young folks to know their pastors well. They don't have to wait till later on in life. They can begin having these conversations early on. When they come to the premarital counseling, I'm already, what I tell them is my goal in these, it's about 4 to 6 hours worth of sessions. My goal is to convince you that you should not get married. That's my goal. Now, I have a 100% failure rate in that regard, but that's my goal. I want to pierce their little happy-hearted souls with questions that are going to make them very uncomfortable so that they are able to speak out. And it is really amazing. Now, that can be because fathers have not developed an intimate relationship with their daughters or sons. That happens a lot. But they will open up to their ministers in a way. If the minister has a close relationship with the children of the church from their earliest days, I mean, they're children that I baptized at the age of 2 or 3 that are about to get married. So they trust me like a second father. And they will say just about anything in my presence. Always a third party is very significant, especially the minister of that congregation. And so in those sessions, I try to make plenty of room for them to deal with whatever differences. And so there's a series of things that I work through in order to prepare them for that time. And by the end, I make a general assessment of whether they're ready or not. And if they're not ready, I will say, let's wait a little bit here. Let's wait. Now, I'm not looking for perfection, but I'm looking for certain key features that this man is prepared, this woman is prepared. And almost always they are. Premarital counseling, by the way, is an incredible gift to the premarital counseling is an incredible gift to the church, and also it's an incredible gift to the state too. It's interesting. In Florida, if you do 4 hours of premarital counseling, you get a 50% discount on your marriage license. Well, that's because the state knows that those who do not go through premarital counseling have a 67% chance greater of divorce. So think about that. So the state's saying to themselves, well, if lawyers get involved in divorces here and they can't pay, that money comes out of our pockets. And so they know premarital counseling is significant. And so I'm registered by the state of Florida, and these kids, they come, and they want that 50% discount.
Well, I was going to ask, what do you do if you're at a church where your pastor doesn't want any more friends?
I was also going to ask if you see if they've both been baptized in the name of the triune God. Funny story, I'll tell you later. So we have a thought or a question. Oh, sorry.
Okay. So you guys are talking about premarital counseling and stuff. Does that, because I know some people who have lived together before marriage, and that, like, gives them an idea of what that would be like or whatever. So do you think premarital counseling can, like, fill that hole or whatever, or do you think they should do that instead?
Well, if they're living together, the first thing I do is, we have a little paper on marriage we do. The first thing I do is, they must not be living together. If they want me to officiate the wedding, now they can ask a local, you know, pastor in the area to marry them. And there are many evangelical pastors that will, but I'm only responsible for those under my care. If they wish me to officiate their wedding, then they must depart from the same domestic location. That's a requirement. If they say no, I say no. It's quite simple. But it's important for them to realize that they need to be living faithfully before they enter into the covenant of marriage. And that's the reality in our day. I mean, that kind of domestic partnership is so common that there are many pastors today that don't even want to deal with it. It's just say, well, it's what it is. Now, there are circumstances where it may be difficult. When I was in Brazil, there was a woman who had been had suffered some abuse, and she fled to be with her boyfriend in his home. Well, they wanted to get married, but there was no place else for her to go. And so we had to make special arrangements. So there are these tricky circumstances, but in a country as wealthy as the United States, those are very, very rare exceptions. But that's the reality. The pastor needs to set those that precedent, so that reality is very... And for a lot of these people, they're not even... They don't even know that they're living in sin. Really? I didn't know this was wrong. I mean, I've had that reaction from folks over the years. And so you have to be very gracious and careful in how you build up a vision of marriage that they will desire, be drawn to, and say in the end of the day, yeah, it's a good thing for us to do this.
Any thoughts on the issue of modesty? Some seem to overreact to the issue of purity culture by saying there are no standards or restrictions. I think the first thing to think through is that modesty sometimes just gets boiled down to the clothes that somebody wears. Modesty is of the spirit, right? Somebody who is immodest, who is flirtatious, or who is not noble and honorable, those are, I think, where I would camp out on more than, you know, is the, are the shorts this short or this short or that short. I think what you're aiming for is a noble woman, an honorable man. And if you're aiming for those things, then some of those clothes conversations are just really far downstream. That being said, I think there's a reason that y'all aren't wearing bikinis right now. You know, like what are the, and yet in other cultures, you know, some of you would be like, you know, people would be freaking out right now at this, you know? So I think some of it's cultural, some of the expectations are there. But having the modest or the noble, the godly character is what I would be shooting for. And if, you know, if somebody's running around, you know, wearing something that's distracting, I think, and somebody brings it to their attention, what reaction they have will indicate sort of where their heart is. If somebody, you know, if Rachel comes up to one of these young ladies and is like, hey, this probably isn't something that you should be wearing, and her first reaction is to stiffen the neck, how dare you tell me what to wear, you've got something there, you know, that's a problem. What we should all be doing at all times is seeking the well-being of our brother or seeking the well-being of our neighbor, and that's men and women included.
Here's another question. Any thoughts on women who are hoping to get married and are making decisions on career, etc.? How cancelable should long-term plans be? How can they work hard while also being open to marriage and the interruption that may happen?
I'm reminded of Doug Wilson's line that says, the goal of every young man should be to cancel the young woman's plans. Not in a bad way, but the idea is to disrupt whatever other plans she had, right? Because he's looking for a helper. You know, he's looking just for somebody to help with the mission that he's been given. And so that immediately comes to mind, kind of based on the language of the question. Other thoughts?
I am deeply concerned about the professionalization of women in our evangelical culture. It's a topic that I've thought through and written about a little bit. I think over the years, in my 14 years as a counselor, I have seen many couples come to me, older parents coming to me, regretting that the wives worked full time when the kids were young, regretting it, that decision. I have never had a couple come to me regretting that their wives stayed at home with their children when they were young. Never. The opposite has always been the case. Now, there are circumstances, what I call sort of wilderness situations, where wives have to work, and I am 100% I understand that scenario. And I also understand that women can be really productive. There are some women in my congregation that work from home 10 hours, 15 hours a week, and probably make as much as I do, because they're very productive in their sales and they use their time wisely when the kids go to bed. These are all doable things. But the professionalization of women in the evangelical church is something that needs to be kept in mind. Because women are going to college no longer these days with the idea, whatever education I get, it's to instruct my children to make them godlier, holier, more intelligent, more skilled in their Bible. That's not the idea. These days, they're going to college in, for pursuit of a career. And that career sometimes is absent of a husband and the children they may have. So the professionalization is where my concern arises.
Yeah, when I worked in the construction company, so many of the women that were there were wrecked with guilt all day, every day. And yet they, either for life circumstance or just sort of expected that they had to work. They're, you know, embracing so many of the more feminist ideas that there's no distinction between men or women at all. And I had one woman quit and go back home, and they skimped, and it was, she said it was the best decision they've ever made. So I think keeping that in mind, what I typically have seen is, if a young woman is on a particular track and she gets really excited about a guy, she doesn't care about the other thing. She typically leaves of her own volition. At the same time, I'm going to encourage my girls to go to school. I'm going to encourage them to get an education. What if her husband dies? What if he turns out to be an idiot? You know, what if we did all the eight principles and their marriage was great for 5 years and then on the 10th year he does an ungodly thing that leaves her stranded with the kids? You know, like, I'm encouraging my daughters to be equipped and to be able to handle some of those things, and yet at the same time keeping her priorities in order.
And I think practical circumstances are going to be part of that too, right? You know, there was a time when one of my daughters had said, oh, well, maybe I would want to go to law school someday. And I think that would be wonderful and great. And I said that. But at the same time, maybe that doesn't make a whole lot of sense if somebody's going to have to go into significant debt to do that, especially if they also have an expectation or a plan for hope for marriage. So there's going to be a lot of practical realities that are going to be part of that decision too. Other questions, Matt?
Here's one. What are the top questions you would ask as a father, I'm assuming, a prospective suitor for your daughter?
Carrie?
Say that again.
Top questions you would ask a prospective suitor for your daughter.
When's the last time you looked at porn? I asked that in premarital, but that would be something I would ask straight away, is figuring out where is this guy as far as his own discipline. So many times guys think, or guys and girls now, they think that I've got this drive, I've got these desires, and once I get married, they're going to kind of go away. That's absolutely not the case, and so often the young woman finds out the hard way that he's not faithful after marriage because he wasn't faithful before marriage. So that would be a really awkward question for him, but it would be one I will ask.
So you're actually starting to ask questions that I had purposely tried to present to you. How would you come to know the person first as a suitor for your daughter? That's really what my focus was. Not that you like buddy up with them, head out and be at the beach with whiskey and cigars. No, that's a whole different level. So that's what my focus was. Sorry about that.
No, you're good.
So it's tough. So I think, again, I go back to the scenario. Every scenario is going to be unique. If there's a young man who approaches my daughter and I know him, I know their family, I've seen a lot of his service in the church, I've seen how he's volunteered and worked to serve God's people at RCC, it's going to be a lot, probably the questions are going to be different than a young
Baptist guy shows up who's I know nothing about, you know, and he could. I know he's a Baptist, but you know, we go to like-mindedness again. But if you have those questions, that it's really going to depend on each situation. If I've seen him growing up since he was 10, 11 years old, and I've seen him serve the church, I'm going to learn a lot about him. I'm going to know a lot about him already, and I'm probably already going to have my eye on him just in case something happens. So there are those questions, you know. The first thing is there's datings for what again, it goes back to datings for one thing only, right? You date for marriage. And everything we do, what do we do it for? For the glory of God. So I'm going to ask him why, you know, if he wants to date my daughter or my son, why? What the reasons for it in marriage? That'd probably be the first question. And then I don't really have anything written out. There's some things that I'll ask, like, when you go on a date, I want you to have a plan. I don't want a guy just showing up going, what are you doing? Well, I don't know. I think that's important that this guy or you know, they have a plan. They're going to do something. They're going to a movie with friends. They're going to go out kayaking. I have a bunch of things that I'm thinking as you're asking these questions. But I don't have a list of 10 questions that that I have ready. You know, the things like, again, he's going to be a Christian, right? He's going to love the Lord. That's definitely, and it, the question is not even going to come up if he's not. Wasn't Bo mentioned? Oh, this guy's got, all of a sudden he likes this girl, all of a sudden, well, he's on fire for the Lord. You know, you want someone you know, or you know a little about. If you don't, there's a lot more questions that are going to be asked.
Yuri, you want to share with the group what you were just mentioning?
Oh, I think Douglas Wilson, who is never lacking with words, has, I think, is a list of between 50 and 84 questions to ask young men or young ladies. It's helpful. You can find that real easily on, I think, Blog and Mayblog. But the other thing I consider is, remember the principle of two or three witnesses. Just last week I had a call from a gentleman living in London who came across a young man who was a part of my congregation before he traveled with the Marines. And he's in London also. And he called me and he said, what do you think about this young man? So he was, and I gave him a very good report. And for the father, hearing a report from a pastor of approval was a tremendous encouragement to him. And so there are men in the congregation that are also watching that young man, or men who have seen perhaps or experienced that young man attempting to court or being involved with their daughter, who can give some additional information. So use the wisdom of your church. Use the wisdom of your local church. The men here are for you. They want the best for you. And that means we have to develop a culture where these kinds of conversations happen a lot more often.
Yeah, the rumor is, and Anna, I don't know if this is true or not, but the rumor that I've heard is that Matt only made it because Dr. Lightheart said he's a good guy. Is that true?
I don't know if it's only, but it was the top.
Okay, so it was a contributing factor.
It's 21
questions. Going back to Michael's talk earlier today, the... He must be a Christian. He must have a level of maturity. And I would just simply stress that I just don't think that those are things that you can assume if they're just on paper. Like, you know, if it's just, I know what church you come from or some things about you. I think that that's something that needs, like, you need to really, really get into, because, frankly, much of the evangelical church is in a slow state of apostasy, and we're watching a kind of a slow crash and burn. There are elements of compromise all over the place. So if you were living in the year, you know, 675 BC, and someone, you know, wants to marry your daughter, and you ask them, like, are you a worshiper of Yahweh? And they say, yes. That, what does that mean in that context? And, like, do you sacrifice to Yahweh on every high hill? Are you,
when you're in a state of compromise, you might still have all of that language that's built in, but you're living basically like the nations around you. And so just checking a little box. Yeah, he's a Christian. Is he? Ask more questions. Get into that character. Is there a real living faith in the God of Scripture?
We should wrap up soon. Are there any other questions? John.
I sent Matt one, but maybe you didn't get it.
I was about to.
Oh, Matt.
You can ask it. You sell.
All right. I'll just read it here. Michael talked this morning and quoted from Deuteronomy, I think it was chapter 7, around giving daughters away and also taking wives for sons. And you talked briefly about parental involvement in helping sons find a wife and marry well. And I'm wondering what might be a way that parents could be involved in their sons' courtships, and how would that look?
I mean, we're involved. I love my sons. Aiden is involved in a relationship, and we basically talk about it all the time. And I don't know, our situation, we knew the family for a long, long time, but we've kept in, I'm in touch with the father a lot, you know, and just how are things going? We've had a lot of long conversations. What can I be doing on my part to encourage things? So I keep up a relationship with them very much, and anything I can do to help, we want them to be blessed. And
I think that one thing, so I think that's really good. One thing I've heard from time to time that I think parents of sons actually need to be careful about, there are times when the parents of sons will gripe about all of the hoops that the parents of the girl are putting their son through. Not an uncommon gripe. There's part of me that's sympathetic to that, but at the same time, you know, that's the father's role, is to make that decision. And there can be some very useful conversations that both sets of parents can have about those issues that might be helpful. But I think in the case of the parents of the son, that's got to be done very respectfully. And really deferentially, knowing that the father of the daughter really has authority to make that decision. And if he decides to do those hoops, even though you might not think it's a good idea or necessary, you know, that's something that your son has a choice to submit to or find somebody else.
I was going to, this piggybacks off, one of the questions we got was a two-parter, and I ignored the second part, but it kind of piggybacks with this one. Which I think the biggest thing that fathers can do is to have a lot of conversations prior to the courtship beginning about how to vigorously take on very difficult trials and make sure that your sons go through difficult trials and are tough enough to deal with a lot of hoops to jump through with a dad and things of that nature. Give them a lot of difficult jobs and work with them. That's, you know, make sure one of the questions that, you know, what do you want to ask a suitor? You know, what are your disciplines around the word? What do you love? You know, what's your favorite book of the Bible? So working with your sons to really kind of, build habits around scripture and prayer. And then also talking with your sons about what does a good wife look like? And not just assume that, oh, he'll by osmosis, he'll look for, you know, he'll understand because of his mom what he should be looking for. But have conversations about, you know, not specifics, you know, not stirring up love, but in the abstract of what really things should you be looking for, and pointing things out that are praiseworthy, and talking with him about that.
Yeah, just as a side note, in the CREC we have a tremendous love for intellectual things. We read very big books. And sometimes what we want to see is a
a young man, a young suitor that replicates us, that he is identical to us, that he loves the same things we do, the same books we treasure. Well, some young men are just not predisposed towards these things. You've got to keep that in mind, that young men come in all sorts of different shapes. This young man may not have the kind of intellectual prowess you have, because you spend your days reading, but he may be an incredible hard worker and a lover of truth, has an objective sense of what's good, true, and beautiful. That's a young man that's worth it. He might not fit the kind of dream profile you have, but his character is sufficient to be the kind of character that will lead your daughter, your sweet daughter, into green pastures.
You know how you can help your sons and daughters is modeling loving your wife. If you're a good husband, and ask your wife if you're a good husband, because you'll get the truth. But if you're modeling what to your kids what a husband needs to be, someone who's serving their wife, loving their wife, you know, a lot of times in the Great Prayer, I'll pray that, you know, I pray that the husbands of RCC not only love their wives, but their wives know they're loved, because it's so important that your kids are seeing your marriages, and that's their first thing that they're going to see. So what if you're doing things that are wrong, they're seeing that, and they're maybe expecting, oh yeah, my dad yells at my mom, so I'm allowed to yell at my wife or my girlfriend. So be aware of what you're modeling. Or my dad doesn't really love my mom. Those are things that be aware of.
Well, and you already touched on this earlier, but I think pastoral involvement is really important. I wasn't here during some of the stories that I've heard, but just because a couple gets married doesn't mean the pastors thought it was a good idea. I've seen families proceed against pastoral counsel. The thing blows up and everyone's mad at the pastors. It ultimately usually is a family decision that they're going to get married or not. And when that decision is made in isolation from wise counsel, it goes bad more times than not. And so if you're a young man and haven't seen good marriages, I mean, I grew up and didn't have a ton of real good examples. So the first thing I was doing is I'm getting to these pastors. I'm getting to my pastors. What should I be doing? What should I be thinking? Here's what happened. How do I think about that? And then do what they say. I know that sounds bad, but if you will listen, it will go good for you. If you don't listen, it will go bad for you, unless God is very merciful and extraordinarily gracious. And he can be, but don't place bets.
Okay, you said that there was another question about dowry.
Yeah, what is a dowry and how to think through it?
Don't pay it in rubles. okay,
about cryptocurrency.
Crypto? Okay, so I did reference dowry briefly or bride price in my talk. I guess we'll mention a few things. So what's a dowry? So this is not what you might have heard about in the land of India. The scriptural dowry was a payment of money that went from the new husband, the suitor, for his wife, either to be held by his wife or to be held by her father for his daughter's benefit. Purposes of the dowry would include honor. You guys will remember these things better than I, but, you know, glory. There's glory, literally, if I recall, means weighty, mm-hmm. Right? So you know, weightiness, money, gold, right, silver. So there's an honor or glory aspect to the dowry, which is then, I think, an excellent symbol that is long-lasting, both the present day as well as in ancient times in that respect. But then more practically or pragmatically, the dowry was also a way to protect the wife. Could be could be a way of providing money for her in the event that her husband died. Could be a way of providing money for her in the event that her husband deserted her. But it was a form of protection as well as a form of honor. Dowry is not something that was necessarily required. People ask whether or not it's something that we should continue doing or not. And it's not something that I would bind somebody's conscience about. I do think that there are a number of things, though, that we ought to consider about it that might mean that it's something we should consider continuing. First off, some of the practical reasons I think can be mitigated, right? I mean, frankly, if I have a suitor come to me, if he marries my daughter, one of the things I'm going to require is a life insurance policy. Probably $1 million or more. Level term, 20 years. I think that that's just baseline. You need that. But that doesn't do a whole lot in the event of abandonment or divorce. You know, we have a court system now which, depending on how you look at it, either treats women well or poorly. I guess it depends a lot on how the man behaved, right? Because most of our states are no-fault divorce states. And so there's a legal mechanism that can provide support to a woman, but we all have lots of situations, I'm sure you do in your church, where the husband, former husband, is a deadbeat and doesn't pay the spousal support or doesn't pay the child support. And then, of course, the lady is having to rely on others, perhaps relatives, perhaps the church. Mm-hmm. So there are additional protections in our day, but I wouldn't go so far as saying that those additional protections make the dowry totally obsolete. And even if it did, I still think the honor or glory aspect of it is very much worth considering. I don't think, and I don't expect, that we will somehow as fathers be requiring a dowry that is as large as what the bride price was, relatively speaking. Okay, I think that would be unlikely based on, you know, what people's wages are, the taxes they pay on those wages, etc. So I'm under no illusions that somehow a dowry is going to be large enough to accomplish all the objectives that it may have had in the ancient world. But I do think it's very appropriate to consider it as part of what a father is doing. The other comment I would make is that, you know, I could see a father saying, you know what, I know this young man, and I know him quite well. I don't have a lot of concerns because he's got a long track record of faithfulness, and so I'm not going to require a dowry, or maybe it's going to be very little. I can also see a situation where there's a young man who is relatively new to faithfulness. And one of the things that the father may want to see is the sustained faithfulness in lots of areas, but to include perhaps the saving of money for a dowry. I could see that being a tool in the toolbox. You guys have anything to add?
Well, times have changed. Obviously, when you have to sit and explain something that hundreds of years ago would have been commonplace, but I think the thing that to just simply remember in all of this is that there's a line that's being very, very effectively communicated to our culture, which is that we don't need these things anymore because there's a safety net and there's social safety net and there's also a police state to protect your women from harm. And the reality is those things are horrible. They don't protect, they don't nurture, they don't care for. Women are being trampled on all over the place in this culture. But still there's this line that we don't need these forms of protection. It's, you know, they would never even word it that way, but it's just the understanding. I'll be fine. You know, the whole dating system, a lot of it has to do with the idea of, we live in safe times now. Everything's fine, you know. And I think that if you just listen to the music that young people are listening to, just flip through Apple Music, you will see tons of trauma and brokenness and girls that are beat up and girls that are scarred and
the words scars and trauma, like they're everywhere, and they're in, that reflects the fact that we have communicated to people that it is very, very safe out there for young ladies to go and make it on their own and to make all these decisions on their own. And in fact, it's not at all.
All right. We're just very gracious because we're going to answer another question. At least we're going to try. Can you ask why fathers have authority / control over adult children's relationships, assuming 21 plus and out of the house? I.e. parents give counsel and advice to grown children, but that's not the same as calling the shots. Correct. So I think this question is somewhat similar to what I attempted to address in my talk this morning, especially with respect to Numbers 30, and at what point might that authority transfer from the father, say, to an adult daughter, for example. And, you know, there's very smart people that would take a different approach on this. I think oftentimes they would say that the normative approach would be that a daughter grows up, she's under the protection of her father, under the authority of her father, and she grows up and is given in marriage to her husband and is under the protection and authority of her husband. But I think what this question raises is, well, what is there an intermediate state where she's not under the authority of any guy, not a father, not a husband, and so I attempted to address that in the talk this morning, and I'm not sure I have more to add beyond what I said this morning, but perhaps you guys do.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of different situations. I think Keller in his book Meaning of Marriage talks about how you know, they would have young people move to New York City, young professionals not getting married until they're 30. And I believe it was Devin that you had addressed at one point. Sometimes there is a sense in which once, or maybe it was you this morning, I can't remember now, once the person has established their own household, they are in some ways, you know, out from under the authority of the parents. And yet, I mean, even the way the question was worded, my hope would be that our kids wouldn't grow up and hit the age of 21 and think, oh, well, dad's not calling the shots anymore, so I'm going to do what I want. Really, by the time your kids are 18, you're not calling many shots. I mean, they're grown. They can move out. They can get a job. They can do a whole lot of things if that's what they want to do. The hope would be by that time, the relationship is such that it is a counsel advice. Here's what I think you should do. Here's what I think you shouldn't do. Here's what I think you might not want to do. And I would be very leery if someone, I don't care if they're 25 and they're getting counsel from multiple wise counselors and their parents are godly and wise and they go against it. The wisest people I know from 7 to 70, they find wise counsel, they ask for that wise counsel, and then they follow that wise counsel and not their own understanding. And whether that's 18 or 21 or 25, I don't know that, you know, if Bailey were to come home at 25, it's like, no, you're not doing that. That would be a pretty extreme situation, which I would do. I mean, if he's not a Christian, I would say, no, I'm not going to support it. I'm against it and, you know, whatever. But the hope would be that the relationship would be a good enough relationship where it's no, that's not a good idea. Here's why. Okay. I think that's wise.
Yeah, just to echo what Pastor Cogbo said, I think the natural dynamic is that fathers go from authority to advisory roles in the family. Now, what happens sometimes, what I've seen happen, is that fathers who have failed to establish healthy relationships with their daughters, who have failed to have their daughters' hearts, when the daughters get older at a certain point and find another man, and the fathers get highly angry because he was not consulted, and then he feels that his authority is being threatened, and he gets angry, and it becomes this entire brouhaha, this entire dynamic that's very dangerous. and that it affects the church at large. And so the key is that you grab your daughter's heart early on while she's at home with you, that you spend time with her, that you have conversations with her, so that these dynamics are natural. That she will say, whether she's 23, 24, because at that moment, unless your constitution is different, she's an independent, she's a voting member of the church, right? And so at that moment, if she has her own little household, that dynamic is still there because it's just a continuation of what was already established in the authority at home. Now the advisory dimension of it continues. And so, but if the relationship is not established, fathers should not be shocked when daughters no longer desire their father's advice and wisdom.
I would just say that I think the Bible is incredibly practical in how it kind of addresses this. I think a number of the scriptures we've looked at address this topic in terms of how widows are treated as they don't have to come back under their father's household. It's understood that they have this way of living that's already established. You don't have to revert back to something else. There's also in the Numbers 30, there's this idea of the father giving tacit approval as well. If a young lady goes off and she's effectively running her own household, she's making all these decisions, you're not going to see the pastors, you know, and she wants to get married. The father has all this relationship is all, this is the household. You're not going to see the pastors come in and grab her and pull her back under this other household and say, you need to submit to the rules of this. This has been established. There's something going on here. And I think we can make a biblical case that's something to be recognized. And this dad can't come in and pull her back in if she's already been released.
Let me make my final point because my bedtime is nigh. I think what you see now in the CREC, we're coming beyond our two decades sort of mark. In the early days, you have things called pioneers in sort of the courtship world. Pioneers are generally men that are not very likable. I can give you lots of examples of those throughout history. They're not very likable, and they establish principles that are very they're hard in the way where they put the lines. And they're very strong principles, and it becomes very formulaic at times. That's pioneer work. There's a significant role for these kinds of men, individuals in the church, certainly in our young denomination. Because remember, we're barely at a drinking age in the CREC. We're about 20, 21, 22 years old. The pioneers have come, and I think what you have heard tonight are some very discerning but very, positions that allow methodologies to differ in the household and in the congregations. Every church is going to have a culture. It's significant that churches have unique cultures because you have more familiarity and unity of thinking and mission in the church. But I think as pioneers have kind of gone by and have established really formulaic lines in some way, it's very important that we come along in the second generation and begin to put some principles down that are much more practical than ethereal. That we avoid and we keep in mind that in some ways, the abuses or how far some of these our forefathers have gone in certain areas. I mean, think about this. In the 1980s and 90s, what was the biggest bestseller in the evangelical world when it came to dating and courting? Anybody tell me? I Kiss Dating Goodbye, right? Written by a 19, 20-year-old guy. And sold millions and millions and millions of copies. And so we are... Obviously, I mean, just think about what happened to that culture. I mean, virtually all those men who were involved in that kind of culture have either abandoned the faith or have gone towards leftism. So we need to be very cautious when we talk about these things, that we develop, as Devin mentioned, very practical ways of approaching this and realizing that even in church cultures, even at RCC or at Providence, Pensacola, there's going to be some distinction, some different ways of managing these things in households, and we need to be very gracious lest we make some mistakes that our forefathers did. And we are much more prone to make those mistakes too. And so we need to realize that we're preparing another generation to consider these issues holistically so that they avoid our mistakes. And that's how covenant works.
All right, Bo is going to close us in prayer. Before he does that, on your way out, remember, take your stuff and your songbooks.
so you can keep chanting.
Yes, so after I pray for Yuri, Tyler's got a slideshow for us. Guys, will you? Father, thank you so much for this week. Thank you for your mercies toward us, for the better-than-expected weather, for the good food, for the fellowship, for the feasting, for the laughter, for the wine that makes glad the heart of men. Thank you for Pastor Brito, the blessing he has been to your people here at RCC. Thank you for his family, for Melinda and Ezekiel and Abigail and Ezra and Ephraim and Elijah, for the joy that they've brought to our kids. I pray that we have been a blessing to them, for they have been a blessing to us. Help us to enjoy these good gifts, be with them as they finish out their trip, bring them home safely to their people, that he might continue to serve and fight the good fight to the glory of Jesus. It's in his name we pray. Amen.